Hello and welcome back to Makerspace for 2025. This is a podcast produced by Christian Education National, a network of Christian schools across Australia. I'm Sam and I hope you've had a great summer and start to the year. I've been putting the first few episodes together for the second season and I'm really excited about the conversations we have lined up. This season, we'll be focusing on the issue of difference. We're at what it feels like quite a tense time globally where differences between countries, political entities, and various groups feel really pronounced. In that context, our students are caught up in a raft of voices on this, and the online space in particular is tricky with its extreme and often toxic tone. In this first episode, we jump straight into the current tensions around difference in regard to immigration with Dr. Matthew Kamik. Matthew is a Christian ethicist and public theologian lecturing at Fuller Theological Seminary. We're actually going to be hosting him at our CEN Executive Conference in March. And in this conversation, I ask a lot of questions based on his book, Christian Hospitality and Muslim Immigration. He also hosts his own podcast, Zealots at the Gate. This is a way of talking about hospitality in a way that's actually not vague, but challenges us to really think about what that means. It's a juicy one, and I hope you enjoy it. Okay, well, I'm very happy to be sitting here talking to Matthew Kamik, who I came across in a conference in Canada, and straight away was actually, I have to say, probably relieved to hear someone addressing big problems of difference and immigration and what it means to live with difference together in a theological way, in a way that I hadn't necessarily heard live before. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. And just to frame this, probably to say that the reason we want to talk about difference and the reason we want to get into the political arena with this is that our students in our schools are very exposed to ideas that are changing quite rapidly. I think the narrative that we've had for a while now is things are simply getting more progressive, more liberal perhaps, and that's what we've got to look out for, but that's actually just not the case. This is actually, there are voices arising which are presenting ideas in hard forms that we haven't seen for quite a while in this way. So I'm looking forward to this conversation, but Matthew, it'd be really great. Hi. It'd be really
great. Hey there.
If you could maybe just say a little bit about what you do at the moment and how you've arrived talking about the things that you have found yourself talking about the last few years.
Absolutely, Sam. It's good to be with you. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I'm a professor of Christian ethics and political theology at Fuller, which is, you know, a large global evangelical seminary. And you know, evangelicals in America and around the world are in a variety of different contested spaces, culturally, politically, and religiously and so forth. Evangelicals are dealing with political differences, economic differences, all these kinds of things. And in the United States, it's a very polarized political environment. And so I think the question for me has been, what is my place as a Christian ethicist helping evangelicals navigate and handle these deep differences? Because, you know, for the most part, we take a sort of animalistic response to difference. You know, it's sort of a fight or flight response where I feel backed into a corner, my shoulders come up, my teeth clench, and I feel like I have to respond in some way. This person has a way of life that's very different from mine. You know, it might be a sexual difference, it might be a religious difference, whatever it is. But it can make evangelicals, just like it can make any human being, when we encounter difference, we can get upset, we can get nervous. We rarely respond in Christ-like ways. So I see my calling as an ethicist to be helping evangelicals think about how do we respond to difference with conviction, like Christian conviction, but also with civility and generosity. And so that's what I'm wrestling with this, you know, in these books and talks and so forth. And, you know, it's challenging, but it's rewarding. I enjoy the work.
Yeah, great. Well, I mean, I sort of framed this conversation a particular way, and from where I'm sitting in Australia and sort of paying attention to online spaces, I just wondered, what are you noticing in terms of the changing rhetoric around difference at the moment, particularly maybe in light of the recent election?
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned online spaces, so that is sort of the new element. I mean, human beings have always been afraid of each other, and we've always demonized each other and fought. You know, that's sort of part of being human. But something new has been introduced in terms of our online identity and interaction. There seems to be, with online interactions, it seems to be easier for us to demonize and distance ourselves from our opponents and really who we are. And that has a way of ratcheting things up quicker. And so for young people, particularly, or those who are just in social media silos where they only see, you know, their fellow people on the left or their fellow people on the right, actually being forced to engage with someone in person in an embodied conversation with deep difference can be almost traumatizing for them. And so I think that's something that young people are struggling to develop and learn. How do I have an open, calm, and curious conversation with someone who comes at life from a very different perspective? And as educators, right, that's a massive challenge. How do I walk with a young person as they figure out, you know, how they navigate these deep differences?
That's right. Well, I think it's Wolf, Miroslav Wolf, who says, I think the question of difference is the crucial question of our age, and it seems to be more and more correct, that I think, that prediction. But you've got a way of talking about difference and the way that it's sort of felt now, and you sort of describe it now as being deep, fast, and close.
Yeah.
What do you mean by those words?
Yeah, so I think those words are really important when we're thinking about these kinds of issues. So, yeah, as we walk through a city like Sydney or New York, we're encountering differences that are deep, fast, and close. Deep in the sense that, okay, it's not just that I like vanilla ice cream and you like chocolate ice cream. It is, we have very different understandings of God, very different understandings of justice, very different understandings about what it means to be human, about what direction our society should be in. So they're deep differences. They can't be painted over. Fast, in that they're coming at us quickly, at a speed that we can't possibly comprehend or understand or make clear, wise judgments about these things, because they're just coming too quickly, like a flashing screen. As you scroll in social media, for example, you can't possibly understand the depth and the layers of each person's short tweet or whatever it is. There's a massive story behind every social media post. There's trauma, there's, you know, all kinds of history between each of these things. So they're coming at us fast, right? These differences are coming at us fast, and then they're close to us. So, you know, I talk about the issue of Muslim immigration. When I was a kid in the United States, Muslims were something that they were people that we saw on television from the other side of the world. They were almost to us like cartoon characters. They were way over there. Islam was more of a theory than a reality for us. But today, you know, my next door neighbor is Muslim. He, you know, his kids play with my kids. You know, it's possible, like it's a very real possibility that one of my children could marry a Muslim. One of my boys could marry a Muslim girl. I could work alongside them. So these differences are not so distant. They're close. And so what all of this means is that as Christians are encountering difference. That's deep, fast, and close. We're going to need some deep spiritual resources to handle that well. We're going to need a relationship with Jesus that is also deep, fast, and close, right? We're going to be needing that sort of intimacy, that sort of safety and security that comes from an intimate relationship with Jesus, so that I don't tighten up, but I can actually open my arms for a level of hospitality and curiosity to that difference, because I know who I belong to. I know who's with me. And I can walk through a city like Sydney or a city like New York and encounter that difference with some expectation and some hope, not just seeing that difference as a problem that I need to solve.
Yeah, well, I want to pick up on that. So I really like that you've framed that and made that explicit, that often we see difference as something that we need to get over or to solve, or it's a problem to crack, when actually it seems to be, what you're saying is, it's an opportunity to practice something really important. And so you talk in your book, I'm actually, for those that aren't familiar, I'm sort of drawing a few of these things from your 2018 book, Christian Hospitality and Muslim Immigration in an Age of Fear. And you begin to talk about hospitality, which can, if we're not careful, be one of those words that just exists in Christian lingo that becomes a sort of a vague, nice principle or concept. The way you are talking about it, though, makes it very clear that hospitality is not vague and it's not just nice. Yeah. It actually makes very challenging demands on us. So I wondered if you could describe, what do we mean when we say hospitality, and why is it such a costly principle to incorporate into the way that we live collectively?
Yeah. So we don't want a romantic or sanitized understanding of hospitality. When I'm talking about hospitality to Muslims, I do not mean, let's all hug each other and sing songs together. And I don't mean let's all agree and let's all worship in the same place or anything like that. Now, the hospitality that we see in Jesus is not romantic or nice at all. It's actually quite costly, quite painful. Indeed, it ends in his death. So he's having a meal. His last meal is actually with a betrayer, right? When I'm calling us to these acts of hospitality towards our Muslim neighbors, there's no guarantee of success. There's no guarantee of comfort. There's no guarantee of agreement. There's only the command, right, that Christ has made space for me, and therefore I must go and make space for others. And I think, today's political environment really does reflect the environment at the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is arrested, right? It's dark, there's shouting, there's clubs and torches and swords. And that's like politics today. And in that particular moment, all of the human beings are engaging in either fight or flight. There's only one human being who can imagine a different kind of response, and that's Jesus. So in the darkness and the chaos and the fear, he reaches out an unarmed hand and he heals. And he doesn't heal one of his disciples, right? He doesn't heal one of his friends on his side. He actually heals someone who's come to arrest him. So that's the kind of hospitality that I'm talking about. And there's more to say about that. And for those listening, and maybe we can talk about this, I am not a left winger on issues of immigration. I am not a sort of open borders, anything goes, everything's okay when it comes to immigration. Hospitality does have limits, and we should have laws. But But yeah, I think the call to care, even for, you know, aggressors, is there in scripture. It can't be ignored.
Mm. I mean, because it seems to be very easy to either fall into, I think even you talk about this, like you like create walls. That's one way of dealing with it. Or, I mean, you talk about this romanticization of difference, which can be on the other side, which is it's either it's fine, it's all going to work out, or like we should see the other group is sometimes even better. And actually, that doesn't really reflect the reality where there are very, very difficult things that we need to work out together. And I guess to pick up on some of your language in the book, which can be picked up from by other groups of people in very different ways. You talk about clash of civilization, and you talk about maybe this clash being between Mecca and Amsterdam. Now, that framing for a lot of people can often put fuel on the fire as we should basically push back or fight immigration. We should try to maintain what we believe, for instance, the West is about. We should preserve ourselves, which is not what you're saying. So I wonder if you could frame this clash of civilization, because it's very realistic. You're not saying that this is going to be easy at all. What you're saying is there's something very real that we have to wrestle with properly and not kind of fall into these temptations of ease.
Yeah. So conflict is real, and conflict of ideologies and worldviews and religions. Those are real things. Those are not imaginary. Trying to paper them over, ignore them, doesn't do any good. Those who would use that kind of rhetoric to try to build a wall, you know, or assert a certain cultural dominance, I think are naive about the, first of all, the effectiveness of walls and the effectiveness of power. It's very hard to stop globalization. It's pretty hard to find a nation that is religiously or culturally pure, and I'm using quotation marks. You will always have difference inside of your gates. You will always have difference inside of your walls. And walls can't stop that from happening. You're going to need to have to figure out how to deal with difference. The other problem is that those who want to sort of assert a manly form of cultural hegemony, right, often betray a deep weakness, a deep fear and brittleness in their worldview. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll use the example here in the United States. If we need to make America Christian again, and we need to make the government Christian again, beneath that is a theological mistake and a theological weakness, which is God can't save America. He's too weak. We have to do it for him. Or Jesus is too small. So we have to do it for him. Or another way of putting it is the gospel just isn't persuasive. So we need political power to enforce it. Like, we don't really believe that the gospel is powerful or persuasive. So we're going to need to take power. Or we're just not willing to do evangelism. We're not willing to share the love of Christ. We just want to impose the love of Christ on people. So I think there's a brittleness there for Christian dominance, but there's also, you can find it just in the secular West as well, which is, you know, people don't seem to be accepting a secular worldview. So we have to impose it on them. Mm-hmm. We have to liberate these backwards religious people from their superstitions.
That's right. And you've got in the book, you sort of touch on this idea that sometimes when we talk about dealing with difference, we're actually calling for assimilation. And the assumption behind that is that there's nothing that the West needs to be challenged on, that we're the ones that everyone else needs to adapt to, because we've got democracy down, we've got the right beliefs about sex and family and politics and religion and the good life. And which is fascinating. But I guess I wondered if you could speak to, is there a way of holding in a healthy way an appreciation for what the West is without falling into this sort of notion of superiority, I guess?
Yeah, so I'll give you a theological response because I think you appreciate that. I think if you have a posture of gratitude towards Western civilization, like I have a posture of gratitude about the freedom of speech and the freedom of assembly and religious freedom. I'm thankful for modern medicine. I'm thankful for modern technology, right? I have gratitude about that. But I see that gratitude. I see those gifts as gifts from God, that are gifts of grace, not so much things that I earned or like white people earned or Western culture earned, but as gifts of grace, that should be stewarded with humility. So it's not inherently, the goodness of white people or the goodness of Western culture or anything like that. That's one piece of it. The other piece is the doctrine of sin, which is an understanding that while these are good gifts of Western culture, every single one of them is touched by sin and injustice and evil and oppression. And that, yeah, they're. The sin's curse has spread in a very pervasive way throughout all cultures, including mine. And so I have that, I need to have that kind of humility that any evil that I might see in, pick your group, any evil that I might see in Muslims or the LGBTQ community or China, or pick whoever you're afraid of. Any evil that you see in them is also present in your own heart. It's also present in you and in your people. There's nothing uniquely good or uniquely evil about any of us. And so I think those two theological truths should allow us to be grateful for the goodness of Western democracy, and yet not prideful. That might be the distinction there. Gratitude versus pride.
Oh, that's excellent. That's very helpful. I'm wondering if I can do something slightly different right now and share, just play a little video for you that I've seen pop up again and again, which might suggest something about my algorithm right now, but I've found it deeply disturbing on one level. Yeah, wondered if I could play this to you. This is a video. I mean, you would have seen this new rise of cultural Christianity that's sort of coming through in a newer way amongst younger people, which again has surprised a lot of people. This is a guy standing in the UK talking about his Christianity, and I was just wondering if I could get your response to this afterwards. Does it sound okay?
Yeah, let's do
We didn't talk about this, so I've just in the
it.
moment thought it'd be interesting. Here we go.
I don't mind your
Christianity is not the cowardly, wimpish Christianity that you want to make it.
What can I
My
say?
Christianity is the Christianity
of
that
violence.
defeated Islamic Jihad 3 times. My Christianity is the Christianity that conquered
people.
The Roman Empire. My Christianity is the kind of Christianity that defeated the pagan Vikings and the northern pagan tribes. My Christianity is the kind of Christianity that defeated the Ottoman Empire, that defeated the Arab invasion of the 7th century, that defeated the Arab invasion in Andalusia, in Spain.
Christianity.
Do you see?
A European, Eurocentric, racist
he sees
Christianity.
It. Oh no,
That's what you
this
got.
Is where you're wrong, because the Ethiopian Christians who follow my kind of Christianity defeated the Muslim invasion from Somalia and Egypt. My Christianity is the one followed by the Armenians and the Georgians who defeated the Persians or Austrians and the Muslims. My Christianity is not for wimps. You're complaining about it because you are.
So,
wow.
Dance music in the background, which is a little bit distracting, but that's pretty strong.
Yeah. What do you think, Sam?
I mean, there's this confusing element that at some points in our history, it was the right thing to do to resist certain things in those ways. And that's the confusing part for this kind of conversation is when is it okay to resist, sometimes even militarily, where it's the right thing to defend, when we recognize something that's maybe deeply Christian within the way that society is that we should actually defend. So I'm sitting there going, this is going to sound very, very reasonable to talk about my Christianity and don't be a wimp, but that doesn't actually match very well onto the person of Jesus in a lot of ways.
yeah. So you sprung that one on me, Sam. So I'm, I think that's good though, because you know now I need to just respond and go off the cuff here. So, you know, normally we academics would like about 3 months of time to research and footnote all of our comments here. I'm just gonna give it to you. So, I like some things and I dislike some things in that. So this is in the UK, correct? Judging by I would share his criticism of a lot of UK Christianity that I have sensed over the last 100 years, a sort of wimpy kind of Christianity. I would agree that Christianity is never and should never be wimpy. But I would also say that I know a lot of pacifist Christians who are badass, tough people. I'm sorry for saying that on your podcast, but I know a lot of Christian pacifists who are pretty darn tough. And to be a pacifist in a time of real difficulty requires an incredible amount of courage and is quite manly. It is not, as he might say, effeminate to be a pacifist. Yeah. And it was quite manly of Jesus to turn the other cheek and to remain on that cross. That was not weakness, that was strength. So it's very mixed, and that's the power of that particular speech, is that it's actually quite close to the truth, but it's a twisting of it, and that's what makes it quite nefarious. Furthermore, his declaration, "My Christianity," right, is he's treating the faith a bit like, well, I'm part of the Labour Party, or I'm part of the Conservative Party, or I'm a Republican, or I am a Democrat. He's treating Christianity as if it's something he possesses, rather than as something that possesses him. And that's a really important problem in the life of faith, is that it is not your Christianity, right? He's not, in a very important sense, he's not your God. You're his. So you don't get to use him as a political sign or a punchline or a tweet. So the declaration, "My Christianity," that just doesn't, that's a core theological mistake from which a lot of his political, you know, declarations spill out. So I think that's another thing that I would say. But, you know, I think a word of affirmation, which I think you were kind of hinting at there, Sam, which is, you know, I am not a pacifist. While I have a lot of respect for my Christian brothers and sisters who are pacifists, I am not. Mm. And so I do believe that there are times when Christian soldiers need to stand up in the face of tyranny and injustice. And I'm not going to legislate all those different countries and wars that he listed as to whether or not each one of them were just wars. But I I understand that. So I run my own podcast on religion and politics with a Muslim friend of mine. His name is Shadi Hamid. And that podcast is called Zealots at the Gate. And this is the last point I'll make on that particular comment you quoted there. We did an episode on an internet figure named Andrew Tate, who's a pretty despicable, manly man, who I think he's like an ultimate fighter, and he's an online personality and is a very intense misogynist. Now, Andrew Tate used to be in some form, shape or form, a Christian, and he made a very public and big conversion to Islam. And the reason he converted to Islam was because he said Christianity is too weak and effeminate for him.
Which isn't that exactly Nietzsche's critique?
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think honestly, Nietzsche understood Christianity better than Andrew Tate. Nietzsche understands the scandal of the cross and what that sacrifice meant in a way that Tate had never really dealt with the courage of Christianity in that way. But that is a thing, right? And what I think is going on here, for that young man and for Andrew Tate and for others in the West is... Islam really believes in something.
Yeah.
And it's not just a personal belief, but it is a public belief. And Muslims want to be consistent in their whole life, and they are committed to it. And many secular Westerners recognize that they don't have that kind of commitment. They don't have that kind of integrity or soul to them. That the Western world has been spiritually hollowed out, that it's spiritually empty. And so they see Muslims moving into the West and filling in that vacuum. And that fills them with fear and trepidation. One of the new atheist guys, I forget who it was, maybe it was Christopher Hitchens or whatever. He's like, I don't believe in God or Christianity, but I want to live in a Christian culture, just because he prefers it to Islam. So there's something like that going on in the West right now, is this sort of cultural emptiness, fear, and rage. And Islam is particularly terrifying because Muslims really do believe in something. Right? They really believe in something all the way down to their feet.
Well, this is, ladies and gentlemen, is why you do ask the professionals and can throw them the deep end like this, because that's a fantastic answer. And I love what you picked up on there, being like, actually to give away your power takes immense strength. It's not weakness. And I think that's really what needs to get reframed here, which sort of brings me nicely on to the section that I'd love to talk to you about, which is you talk about the nature of God shown in Jesus in a particular way, that he's spatial, he's temporal, he's naked, he becomes the victim. And I feel sometimes what we've got in this arena, especially when we call on God in some way to back up what we believe, like what you were talking about before, often it can almost feel like a Zeus versus Jesus thing going on. So I wonder whether you can sort of unpack, why is that theology of understanding who Jesus is so core to how we then live that out?
Yeah, tell me more about this Zeus versus Jesus thing. You threw me for a loop. What does that mean?
I think simply, I mean, Zeus is the god that makes sense that people would make up. He's strong, he's powerful, he does whatever he wants. He has lots and lots of descendants, we'll put it that way. He is the picture of power, as we're often led to believe is what it's supposed to look like. Christ, on the other hand, is not what we would probably make up as what power should look like, and it's deeply confronting, and I think
consistently a scandal to a West that likes the previous form of power. And I think what you do so nicely is to draw that out and to say we need to constantly have that challenge us on how we position ourselves in this conversation.
Yeah, yeah. So I think what's unique really about the Christian faith is not a belief in God, it's a belief in the cross. So that's what makes us strange. That's what makes us odd. And for Christians, we really do believe that the cross is the key to understanding what's going on in the world. And there are a number of aspects of the cross that are instructive for us living in a polarized society. So, we've talked about what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane and the healing. You know, amidst fight and flight, there's this healing. Another is, as you mentioned, the actual nakedness of the cross is this interesting and instructive moment in that when the soldiers took the clothes away from Jesus, they mocked him. They imagined that they had exposed him as a fraud, as a failure. You know, they took his clothes and they showed the world who Jesus really was, a failed rebel against Roman power. But one of my favorite theologians, Klaus Schilder, he says that's actually not what happened. The exact opposite happened. Jesus actually exposed them, and not only exposed the Roman soldiers or the Roman Empire, in his nakedness, he exposes all of us. In that all of us participate in nailing him to the cross. That's an important thing that Christians believe, that in some kind of mysterious way, we all put him there. None of us are innocent. We're all sitting at the foot of the cross, laughing and participating in that. And so Jesus stripped us naked there on that cross. And you know, it's instructive that the very first thing that God does for human beings when they sin is he gives them clothes, right? He clothes us very graciously. And the last thing that we do to him is we take his clothes from him. And so, you know, when it comes to political fights or religious fights, we like to dress each other up in terrible clothing, right? Muslims are horrible. Gay people are awful. Black people are this. What, you know, rich people are this. We like to demonize the groups that we don't like. The conservatives are awful, or the liberals are awful. Dress them up as if they're an alien species. That's something totally different from who we are. The cross has a way of stripping all of us bare and forcing us to look at our own propensity for violence. And, but Schilder, you know, this, it's a real downer, right? This isn't a fun thing to talk about, but Schilder thankfully has this to say at the end. He says, graciously, Jesus doesn't leave us at the foot of the cross naked and shivering. He says, Jesus actually clothes us again, but this time he clothes us with himself. So coming down from Calvary, walking away from that, how do Christians enter into a city like Sydney, a city like New York? How do we handle difference that's deep, fast, and close? Well, we handle it clothed with Christ, with the memory of the cross, that we are no better than our opponents. We are no more in no better position, that the clothes that we have, we did not earn. And so that gives us a different posture when we encounter deep difference as followers of Jesus. And we see him as someone who has out arms outstretched to a world that hated him and wanted him dead. And that purchases us for public lives of hospitality, I would argue.
Mm. That's beautiful. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but one thing that was very interesting to me and of interest to our network is, you know, we are very much have a very strong heritage built on the work of Abraham Kuyper, which sounds like you share, which was a nice thing to discover.
Yeah, I love Abraham Kuyper.
Yeah, in the book though, you use him and you appreciate what he has to say, but you also say, look, here's some things that we might want to maybe develop a little bit more. So I wonder if you could just briefly speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, so what I love about Kuyper, what's really wonderful is his emphasis on the sovereignty of Christ, or that Jesus is king. And why that's so important is that what Kuyper's going to say is, you know, Jesus is king over Australia, not Christ is king over Australia, not Christians. So the knowledge that Christ is king should relax all of the Christians in Australia, because they don't have to take Australia back for Jesus, because Jesus already has it. And the gospel is fired and powered by the Holy Spirit. It's not fired and powered by our will or our organizing power. So our political action doesn't come from a sense of desperation, or fear or hatred or anything else. Our political action comes out of an experience of grace, to demonstrate that grace and hospitality and justice to others. So that's what I love about Kuyper, is that the sovereignty of Jesus offers us a moment to breathe politically. What I'm missing about Kuyper is that he uses this king language all the time, which is great, but Jesus is more than a king. Right? Jesus is also a servant. Jesus is also a friend. He's also a host of hospitality, as we talked about. There are many other images of Christ and many other moments in Christ's life that are instructive for how we deal with difference. And, you know, I just think there's so many different parts of Christ's life that can help us navigate these questions that we're dealing with. And so often, honestly, I see Christians behaving publicly just like everybody else. You know, their political speech, their political habits, their fears sound just like the world around them. And I would like them to be conformed more to Jesus.
That's so helpful. Well, I've written down about double the amount of notes that I've managed to get through, which is always going to happen. But it's been so great to talk. And the exciting thing for us is that you're actually coming over near the beginning of next year for our executive conference.
I know, it's my first trip to Australia, man. I want to see the Opera House. Can I hug a koala or something? I've never been. Is that safe?
I think they're a bit aggressive.
Oh dear.
Aggressive or totally stoned from the eucalyptus. We'll have to work that out. Maybe we can get someone to dress up as a koala for you and you can hug them.
No, man, I'm really looking forward to coming to Sydney. I think it's going to be great. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing everybody in person. So that'll be good.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to the challenge that you bring, actually. And, you know, we're actually pushing us to think deeply about this stuff at a really a crucial time to be doing that. So really appreciate all your work. You've given so much time and thought and energy to all of this work, and it's such a great resource for the church at large. And we're deeply appreciative to have a little bit of that, and to actually be able to pick your brains a bit, and just actually to have you now as a friend that we can sort of draw on in the future. So thanks so much for your work.
Absolutely. Rich blessings to all the Christian schools there and churches in Australia. And I look forward to seeing you in March.
Sounds good.
Thanks for joining. If you're keen to keep learning and accessing more of CEN's resources, why not subscribe to the Christian Teachers Journal, a publication of the National Institute for Christian Education, the postgraduate arm of CEN. Go to CEN's website, which is in the show notes, and under publications, you can take out an annual subscription to CTJ and receive your own copy of the 4 editions. From time to time, you might even find some writing from our podcast guests. See you next time.